Okay, cool. Yeah, let's wait a sec.
Yeah, I'm just gonna give them like one more minute, see if anybody else shows up, and then we'll get started.
Yeah.
We should have held this space on Valentine's Day to shake out the weak hands.
I think the weak hands seem already pretty shook.
Fair enough.
Yeah, biggest problem is always making sure you don't have like too many people on your spaces. That's always the trick.
Yeah.
What are you drinking, Tim? Sounds like you have cups clinking.
That's Daniel banging a spoon, or he's drinking orange juice with a spoon.
Wow, innovative.
Yeah, unfortunately.
My daughter eats sandwiches. I fixed her sandwich this morning, and she eats sandwiches from top down, one layer at a time.
How many layers are your sandwiches?
Well, you know, there's like breakfast sandwiches, like bread. She eats the bread, top bread, then the, you know, like the eggs, and then the ham, and then the bottom bread.
The cool thing about her approach is that you don't actually have to worry about, you know, how many layers there are. She's just going to tackle them the same way. Like, the approach doesn't change. You just, you know, top down.
Yeah, I'm pleased that she's already taking a very modular approach to her eating. It bodes well for my engineer daughter future.
And to her blockchains.
Yeah. All right, we ready to get started?
Yeah, we can do it. Do you want to ask us like stuff to kick it off?
Yeah, it's just to announce. I mean, obviously it's a crypto and keynote, so that's the topic today. So welcome to Basile and Doria as usual. So yeah, the first question then is just a sort of broad one. What's Keynote's position in crypto?
All right, so right off the bat, we are not a chain ecosystem. We have the option to, like, you know, put a chain of our own into our ecosystem, but I think this is a confusing thing for people because of where we've been. But the best way to think of us right now is, you know, obviously we have these nodes, and the idea of them is they can connect to any chain, you know, L1s, L2s, whatever, and try to, like, you know, whatever kind of program you want to write, you can now write it as, you know, a normal, like, off-chain program with lots of, you know, parties connected. And anytime any of those parties need to hit, you know, crypto, they can. So the basic uses of that are, you know, what you would expect. Maybe you all work together to compute something off-chain and then update a much smaller stake that you've all signed. But you can also do lots of ZK stuff. If you have a ZK verifier on any chain you want linked to any contracts or payouts, you know, you can coordinate that whole computation via, like, the key nodes, throw data between them, and then, you know, prove any relevant part of it and throw it in there. So I guess what we are is with regard to chains, we're a chain integrator. We do everything else that's not the chain computation. And then, you know, any parts of it that need to go on there, we can plug into those chains as necessary.
Then Doria.
Yeah. Do you have anything to say about that? Yeah, it's pretty important because obviously we've taken different routes in the past, but this is really the goal that we've had all along since the very beginning of this project, is to make a system that integrates on-chain and off-chain computation in an actually easy to develop on way. And so the route that seems by far the most promising for that right now is to build this off-chain peer-to-peer node-based computing infrastructure and then integrate with existing chains. And specifically, I think the most promising or exciting would be Ethereum layer twos, because you basically have a nice balance of things that's complementary to this approach. You've got multiple chains which have assets on them. They have TVL, they have useful applications running on them, they have a good security model, and they're somewhat fragmented. And so the node-based off-chain approach is really interesting for potentially resolving that fragmentation. And that's, I think, something we should talk about today.
Yeah, I agree that like L2s are a very natural fit here, because they already answer the question of how do you secure this, how do you bridge assets on, what kind of assets can you work with? But then, as you said, they then do have the question of, you know, I guess fragmentation. I mean, if you're dealing with like, I mean, they often have like multiple parts you need to coordinate, even if it's just the L1. So yeah, I think they're really, really natural. I just don't want people to think we're like, you know, excluding, you know, other chains and that they're not possible or something.
Yeah, no, everything's possible, of course. And yeah, even like, you know, something you briefly mentioned is like, yeah, it's definitely possible to build like, you know, a quote unquote native layer 2 or layer 1. And it's like sort of a theoretically interesting concept, but in practice, the project is not successful if it requires the layer 1 to be integrated tightly with the node. In order to be useful, because the entire point is to be able to integrate stuff that people actually use, right? Stuff that's out there, stuff that has value, and coordinate those things. So yeah, that sort of gets into like the cross-chain stuff too. It's like you could take two existing systems and coordinate them together for your own use in your node running a program.
All right, so maybe the next question is, what chains are we on currently? Or which chains do we work with currently? And do you see anything that makes sense to also integrate in the nearish future?
Well, so right now we're running our basically development testnet on Sepolia and Optimism. So we have, and there's actually some nuance here, because it's not like, you know, it's not like we're running computation on those chains. So basically, we have an identity system where we, you know, have a globally available PKI on chain. We have that deployed to Optimism and Sepolia. Those contracts are, you know, under development and upgradable, but they're out there and they're being used for development. And that's sort of like the idea is like, okay, we've got sort of a main net on Optimism and then a test net on ETH Sepolia. I encourage people to launch their nodes on the test net just because that's more like useful. But then that's just the PKI, right? So like there isn't a bunch of other stuff happening on these chains. So now we get into this idea of like multiple chains. We have a program that's called the App Store, right? And that uses an on-chain contract that's very similar to the PKI contract, actually, in order to list apps available for download, right? That's on Sepolia because we're building it, right? We're actively developing it again. But that could be on a different chain than where the PKI lives, right? You could have the App Store run on Optimism and then the PKI run on ETH layer 1, right? You can have all sorts of combinations here, because
that might be a good thing to like kind of ask or get into a little bit. Like, as you're developing App Store next to the PKI in that setup, have you felt it to be like a big constraint to have them on different chains, or has that been relatively easy to work with, or how do you feel about that whenever you do split it and have to sort of put two of those things together?
So, yes, there's two things that are like a little annoying, right? So one is at the node level, something that we're working on for the next release is this like, you know, indexing by chain ID. So like our nodes have basically, you know, Ethereum provider, you know, RPC data ingestion, right? And they present that data as an API to applications. That's one of like the core APIs, right? Along with like HTTP, you know, you need to be able to read and write chain data. So the tricky thing is like right now, like the software is sort of, you know, one dimensional in that you boot up a node and you give it an RPC and you're like, all right, you node, you're looking at Sepolia, you know, and that's it. And Marcus is here, so maybe he can come up as a speaker, but one of our lines of work right now is to genericize that and let you be able to pass a chain ID, which would allow, of course, any chain that follows like the ETH RPC standard. Basically all EVM chains would just like be a chain ID that you could plug in there. And then your app could query a specific one. So the PKI indexer app would query wherever the PKI lives. And then the App Store app would query wherever the App Store is. And that would be a non-issue. Right now it's an issue because we need to genericize that. The other part of that is like the on-chain part where you're talking about, okay, if the PKI contract lives over here, and the App Store contract or some other like a game contract lives over here, is that contract going to be able to operate on the identities on chain? And that's also an issue because the answer by default is kind of no, right? It's much more difficult than if you're like on the same chain, you can interact with the contracts. But there are ways around that too. So like in the same way we use like layer zero for signing, ENS ownership, on Optimism, you could do the same thing with our identities. But yeah, it's definitely more complex. Worth thinking about.
Yeah, this is getting me into like something else. Like as you, because I think the next natural question is, okay, why just EVM? What else do you add? Is EVM suitable? I know we've been through a lot of iterations in our past when we've been looking at alt VMs and stuff like that, but as I think one big difference from when we first started Ookbar and now Keynode, which was over, you know, it's getting close to 2.5 years at some point, you know, 2 years now, but, you know, won't be forever. ZK stuff has gotten way, way more commoditized than we expected. Like, even if you look at the beginning of 2022, not that long ago, mid end 2022, it looked like ZK was going to be this sort of high value point. And now there's stuff coming out where they're basically just giving away really, really good stuff, higher performance than people imagined, like for free as open source. And that then leads to things where you're like, okay, we can talk about how ergonomic or whatever EVM is, but maybe you do start to get a new paradigm where there's these like really simple commoditized contracts that can run on, you know, any EVM chain. So anywhere there's liquidity, you can put them. And then you can just make contracts that are in, you know, in Rust or something, and just verify them there. And so you can like, you know, have the hashes of the contracts and the code you run, publish it in sort of an App Store, process declaration kind of way. And then let people, you know, just run that. I mean, you might be able to make this like richer ecosystem where people deploy much, much, much simpler Solidity contracts, that are just sort of rock solid and, you know, hold value, and then extend them, with off-chain stuff. So I think this is something people haven't even really looked at, because the reason you want until now, the reason that you've wanted to have everyone on, let's say, you know, in L2, or actually like, let's call it on chain for like a ZK rollup or something like that, is because you need a way to reference their identities in the contracts and do stuff and send things between them and do it. But if you have another identity referencer and can sort of coordinate people outside of that, it might just make sense to start doing tons of stuff off chain and doing, just letting, you know, people would just be like spinning up almost like these ad, like almost little L2s or something like that, that would just exist for a little bit. And it might be very easy then to, you know, sort of just spin those up, have them go. And all they need is some value locked on some EVM chain. And then you can use very simple commoditized contracts with more complex Rust contracts on top to unlock that. So I don't know, it's kind of a bit of a monologue, but just sort of there's a lot of really new patterns here, and just robustly supporting all EVM chains gives us the ability to write very generic programs that can target any of them that have, you know, the liquidity that a given like part like sort of use needs.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So the next question then is, why do I want to use Keynode instead of like a fast blockchain like Solana, or maybe a more full-featured one like Near? Why do I want to choose to use Keynode when I could do that?
Well, this gets into a lot of stuff that we've felt for a long time. So the first issue is that, sort of like, I guess, you know, I'll steal, man. Like the hyperscale layer one, or just hyperscale chain thesis, revolves around wanting to put significant quantities of computation on chain, right? That's sort of the entire point. And in practice, like that basically just looks like running sort of a traditional application model, but on chain, right? So you have a smart contract that's the core business logic of your program. It does its thing. You can ask people to submit transactions to it, and that's the beginning and end of it. It doesn't seem like that's the right tech tree for decentralized applications. It seems wrong. And you know, unfortunately, like a lot of time and energy is going into these like layer one projects because it's, I think it really boils down to like metrics, right? It's really easy to measure metrics like you know, transactions per second, you know, TVL, state, stuff like that. But from an architectural perspective, it makes a lot more sense to minimize the amount of data that's on chain and use tools that are more suited towards data storage. Because misusing like the blockchain tool for mere data storage is wrong. I mean, Bazil, what do you think about that?
VC bags and then user bags, like on top of that. Like, I think I think you can sort of never underestimate how much jealousy there is that Bitcoin and then Ethereum sort of launched and captured huge amounts of value. And ever since then, that's been a target for ambitious developers and investors. And so I think you're really, really looking at just like there's just so much incentive to, you know, go at that and say kind of misleading things and not analyze it well, or you know, trick yourself or do whatever. Because like you're just so sort of jealous, or in the more generous version, at least there's this target of, if we could convince people of this narrative, there's a, you know, $1 trillion upside, which is ridiculous, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's frustrating to, I mean, I think one of the pieces of evidence of this, and this is like, you know, pretty robust, is, you know, Electric Capital does an ecosystem report, and they collect a lot of stats about a bunch of different smart contract chains, and they release developer stats and things like that. And one of the most notable findings over like the past several years, I don't know of a year which this hasn't held true, is that novel smart contracts, basically like smart contracts that do like new things, right, almost universally get launched like on Ethereum, and then they sort of percolate out. And, you know, you see this with like, all the way to like the consumer applications, right? You have like stuff like Stars Arena, which was like, you know, the Avalanche sort of response to Frentech, you know. And interestingly, right, like there are legitimate reasons to go for a product like that and put it on like a different chain, because, you know, there's a speed boost. But what really happens is that, you know, a developer creates a novel experience, and then there's a perverse incentive to copy that, and you get grant money, you get funding. I mean, everybody who's done like programming work in crypto knows like the sort of like the spouts of money that come from doing things like that. And of course, you know, that's not really getting us as an industry anywhere, right? Because that novel experience already existed, and there's weirdly, this is the really weird thing, is the scaling of it doesn't do anything significant in terms of like the actual experience. And this is where we get into like why we're doing this whole peer-to-peer compute thing to begin with, is like, you know, we believe that in order to increase the richness of the experience as opposed to just the scale of the experience, you need off-chain. Like you need off-chain peer-to-peer interactions. It just doesn't, being able to do more buying and selling of Frentech shares doesn't measurably impact the experience of using that social product, like at all, right?
I think my first answer was also, I mean, I believe it. It's also a little bit moralistic, like, okay, you know, people sort of shouldn't be doing this because X, or I think it's stupid, or I know their motives. From a just performance use case perspective, what you're sort of promising with scaling is that it's kind of this thing of like, all right, we know you're sort of not supposed to use blockchains as databases, but we can, like, you know, make the scaling trade-offs so you can kind of keep doing it and just push the frontier by one, maybe two orders of magnitude so that you can kind of try to do some things. Or again, in the more cynical version, maybe try to, like, show people proofs of concept of some things and hand wave over the fact that this won't scale very well. And in all cases, what people are always wanting is this richer off-chain environment. When I say wanting, their designs sort of, you know, imply it. And so I think that's where, when we say what we can give that those other ecosystems can't, or why, you know, they would even need to integrate with us, is that there's just very, very, very fundamental limits to how much a consensus-based system can scale. Everyone knows this. And, like, usually what they'll argue is that, okay, we can go 10 or 100 times faster, and that'll at least unlock some new use cases. But so much of what happens in computation, I think people have bad intuitions for how much orders of magnitude can differ. So it feels like if you're like, oh, it's 100 times faster or 10 times faster, so much stuff must be unlocked. But most of the useful stuff that people want to do happens at, like, data throughput levels and computation throughput levels that are more like, let's say, a million times faster, or 10,000 times faster, or 10 million times faster. And, like, the difference between 10 times faster and 1 million is just so big that it's not an optimization problem. And so, to come back, what we provide is we give you access to those orders of magnitude in a blockchain context. And I think that this is something we've seen a lot in these kind of both distributed systems, blockchains, everything, where people, again, often to pump their bags or to keep the, you know, research money coming, we'll really try to obfuscate, like, you know, multiple order of magnitude differences as, you know, just an optimization problem. And it's extremely disingenuous, but it, you know, it does work because developers are used to seeing, like, you know, things get faster or performance things not matter. And so you just sort of lose sight of, you know, how big these differences are. Like, you know, a 10 time order of magnitude difference is the difference between me and, you know, a 1-year-old baby. And, you know, 1,000 times is, you know, we're talking about, like, you know, blue whale versus the baby. And that's, it hasn't even gotten into the million part. So, yeah, just intuitions here are really, really, they're scamming people by saying, you know, two orders of magnitude and five don't sound very different, but they are.
Right. Well, it's like the metrics game again, is like that. And there's, I would say that, like, system architecture is really not about metrics, and it's really about qualitative improvements. I don't know. It's very interesting. And, you know, we still have to prove this. We still have to, like, really be able to point at discrete things and show people that, like, look, like, you will never do this through the transaction. And like, that's another thing. When I say, like, qualitative, like, something that's irked me for a super long time is that if you are building a transaction-based, you know, backend, right, which is every blockchain, right? Every blockchain operates on like the unit of a transaction. That percolates all the way up to the user interface and the user experience. And so I want to get away from that model as much as possible. You know, I don't think programs that have transactions as the basic unit of interaction are ever going to break out past, like, DeFi and trading particularly. And those use cases are very successful in the transaction-based context because that's a natural fit, right? The user interface of trading stocks is the transaction.
But if you want to have a thriving DeFi and, like, digital, like, stock market, you need to have incredibly interesting and useful applications on top of that and plugged into it. And so DeFi is very, very sterile until you add something like this. And then once you have something like this, like, absolutely, we can, it's not that hard to imagine a world where Solana or a fast ETH2 is executing transactions based on, like, very rich interactions that have been, like, checked in by Keynote. And, like, you do sort of start to get this, like, you know, digital stock market going. It's not hard to imagine at all.
Yeah, the whole Bloomberg terminal thing is pretty interesting. That's something that we've, like, talked about for a little while as, like, a product that would highlight this. You know, you look at, like, the Bloomberg terminal in traditional finance, and it's, like, a really, really important product. It's a social network, it's a tool, it's an automation platform, and all of it's happening like quote unquote off chain, right? It has nothing to do with like, you know, the settlement layer. But yet it's really important.
Yeah, I've poo-pooed the Bloomberg terminal a lot, but it actually might be, it might be pretty interesting if we could find you know, an active enough thing for people to be kind of, you know, trading around.
Yeah.
Which implies.
Yeah, I mean, this also kind of gets into why I'm so excited about like the SP1 stuff, and what we were talking about just a little while ago, Bazil, is like the basically the model that's been theorized for like years now, right? But isn't yet making its way into production because of various like integration reasons and just like, you know, convenience reasons, is the system where you're doing a lot of work off chain, you're collecting it into a proof, and then you have a very simple contract that's posting that. Yeah, it's like, I think that pairs.
I mean,
really
if
well.
Like if Goldfinger's on here, like we could try to show it. Like one of the more interesting, like sort of easy to grok SP1 things would be, I'm in the middle of. Would be. One sec.
We're all
while we're taking a second. Yeah, while we're taking a second, if anybody wants to request speaker privileges to ask a question, go ahead and do that.
I was gonna finish and say, like, if you could, and I'm not sure whether this ends up reinventing L2s too much or actually just being really interesting, but you could do a protocol to like update JSON NFTs where there's like a sort of ad hoc almost validium running the data off it, and then just use simple ZK proofs to show that a given like metadata JSON transition was valid from like the one before based on a state update. That's actually like really straightforward and an easy one. And then you could even, you know, batch all those together in batches, again with almost a sequencer type thing run by the project, and then you could actually just apply that robustly to the NFT itself and be like, okay, now we actually update the NFT's metadata on chain based on this. Would make a lot of sense in an L2 context. Even L1, it's, you know, it's definitely cheaper than a lot of alternatives, even if it is somewhat expensive. So there's like definitely pretty cool stuff like that you could make right off the bat.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, it also speaks to me with regards to like the EVM question and sort of like alternative, you know, state machines and virtual machines for on-chain work is like something that's also kind of a pet peeve of mine is the idea of like the, you know, the alternative virtual machine that doesn't have the account-based model or is like, you know, somehow more advanced architecturally, right? More fragmented. Which those two are synonyms in this context. Sometimes like simplicity is really, really nice and important. If nothing else for developer experience, you know, you find like people inventing really, you know, impressive state models that, you know, you look at and you're like, ah, that's really cool. Like there's a couple really nice use cases that are used as the examples. And then you're like, oh, well, I'm not gonna build anything on that. It's too Byzantine. So that's another place where like the complexity is really nice off chain, you know, to put into a sort of bespoke protocol where you as the developer have full freedom. Because as a developer, right, as a programmer, like you really want to build nice abstractions and you want to do things your way. I think everybody that gets really into programming has that sort of like personality, right? Sometimes contrarian, you know, idiosyncratic, and you want to build things.
Product direction we might want to look at, which is just like, you know, just get a verifier on chain at some point. You can start with it off chain and use a trusted source, and then swap it in for on chain, and just start like encouraging people to write like tons of like, you know, ad hoc ZK proved things that like do sort of look like L2s in a lot of cases, but have, you know, clear, like, sort of, I guess the difference that you can just sort of do them. And maybe just like that, like you can easily imagine a world where ZK proofs existed prior to blockchains, where this would have become like really popular. If sort of Keynote had predated blockchains, then they had come out, this would have been sort of an obvious pattern.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, so, but But that's the thing, is like, if you're building infrastructure, like, you want to let the idiosyncratic contrarian developer like do their thing, right? You don't want to like be like imposing your thing on them. That's sort of like a anti-pattern. And I think the sort of simplicity of the account-based structure is really nice there, actually, and pairs well with this off-chain ZK work really nicely.
Goldfinger, you've got speaker privileges if you have anything you want to say.
Really, the only thing I've been thinking about doing this, Chad, is that, like, you know, people have sort of, like, poo-pooed Validium architecture just because it's, like, somewhat trusted. And I think that we basically have gotten rid of a lot of those issues, or we have the potential to, because, like, the question is always, like, okay, like, the data lives off-chain, which allows for, like, massive scalability, but then who is the data being served by? And, you know, how do we make sure that we actually trust them? So I think, like, the first people to launch a Validium were, like, Starkware, and basically their answer was, like, well, we're running the data availability committee, so you just have to trust us, which doesn't feel great. But, you know, if you make it really easy to just, like, run this data, or, like, run these availability nodes, and then you can even design, like, more, like, protocol-y stuff on top, such that, like, if you are providing data availability, then, like, maybe you're, like, mining a token or something like that, which I think Keynote would make much, much easier. Then, like, the sort of trust assumptions of a Validium go, like, are not eliminated completely, but go, like, way down. And then, like, the amount of scaling that you can get out of that is, like, huge, because you're really just verifying the computation. You could even do that on, like, an L2, so you're effectively doing, like, a Validium, like, L3 architecture where all the data lives off-chain and, like, a network of, like, Keynote nodes. And then everything's verified on, like, Optimism, where it's super cheap. And then, I mean, potentially you could even build, like, a huge file system out of this, like, IPFS scale, right? Because just none of it has to go on-chain, which is awesome.
I think what the architecture looks like is a verifier on Optimism, because, as you said, you can drastically reduce the, like, cost of doing the verification. It's not data intensive, it's just computation intensive. So you run the verifier on Optimism, you can pass messages to ETHL1 if you want, maybe with the verifier there, and then you just go kind of wild. I mean, I guess technically this is like a quote-unquote L3, but yeah, no, it's honestly, we probably should just do something like this soon, and we're sort of hitting it from a lot of angles. And you're right that Validiums are a lot more interesting when you can make a protocol with them on top and maybe hold some pieces steady, like the ZK proving, and also have it a lot easier and hold a piece steady in terms of how do people join the protocol. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And so a lot of this is, like, just starting to open up. And I think we've been building with the expectation this stuff would happen. And now a lot of it is starting to happen next to us, and we're sort of finally ready. So you could imagine that, like, if all this ZK proving stuff hadn't been happening, or had been happening in parallel, but we hadn't been building, then, you know, we'd be like, oh, if you had something like us, then you could do this. But now I think we have sort of both things at the same time. And that's where it gets actually, like, interesting, like, actually having it, not just in theory.
Yeah, it almost makes me think back to when we were building on Urbit, like, why? Because we were thinking about building an L3 on Starknet, and the whole issue was just we couldn't get, like, data availability. And so, like, you know, we had to fall back to Validiums. And then for some reason, the idea never came up to do, like, data availability committees using, like, Urbit IDs and, like, nodes. Probably just because of, like, lower throughput and, like, bandwidth.
No, I had thought of it. Throughput was an issue, but actually the bigger issue was just that I think people are, like, really sleeping on how much the new work, like Syncs and others, and to some degree Risk Zero, is just, like, obsoleting what Starkware was doing. They got obsoleted really fast, and you can see that in their morale. Their token event isn't, like, a big deal now. I think their CEO left, maybe for other reasons due to situation in Israel, but, like, there's just a lot of energy is, like, going away from there now, because what they were doing originally was really cool. And just in a very, very short period of time, it's become commoditized in much more normal languages. Like, the idea of just being able to write Rust programs instead of, if anyone here's ever written anything in Cairo, it's pretty brutal relative to it. I think the reason that we didn't do it is just that a lot of stuff has happened that's different now in the last year and a half from when we've looked at those things. And sometimes it's good to kind of take your head up for air, look around, see what is there now. And the answer right now is there's a lot of really cool, it's a very target rich environment.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a decentralized, like, L3 architecture is, like, really possible, like, almost it's pretty doable, much in today's technology. Like if you just put like a month or two of work into it, well, I don't know. There's always productionizing.
I think the only thing missing, I think the only thing missing would be like an on-chain verifier for like SP1.
Yeah.
Which I that was like the first thing I asked GA Const once they like announced this yesterday or like talked about, you know, their docs is like, okay, is there an on-chain verifier? And it looks like the answer is, you know, soon.
Cool.
Okay. Anybody wants to ask a question, please just request speaker permissions. Next question that I have is, what do we have to offer? What does Keynote have to offer with regard to the Ethereum L2 roadmap?
Yeah, well, we've talked about this from a lot of different angles. We can just come out and say it, which is that a lot of the stuff that Ethereum wants, there's different types of solutions they have for handling L2 fragmentation. You know, things like shared sequencing, obviously, I think, you know, Justin Drake did the big Bankless podcast about that. And all of it is much, much easier to do if you have a really robust, easy to use off-chain environment, lets you do a lot of the protocols they imagine. So I think if ETH L2s succeed, it will probably be because, you know, we or something like us catches on massively as a way to coordinate this. And right now there isn't anything particularly like us, so we're going to try to, you know, occupy that. But this is, you know, at some point in life, you do have to make your bets. And while we're open to the idea of integrating with all L1s, I think we're just so interested. The fit with us and really helping Ethereum to make L2s ergonomic is so obvious that I think that's something we really want to target. And so the answer is, how do we help? Is we enable all the programmatic coordination that helps to defragment things. Defragmenting is mostly, it's a matter of them fixing some primitives at the base level. But then it's a matter of just having the off-chain software to be able to actually implement those ideas on top of those primitives. So I think that's like a pretty exciting thing that as we get better and better, we'll probably, you know, we'll go to, you know, various chains there that are interested in it and, you know, show them what we can do for them. And just as, you know, for Ethereum as a whole, I think I would like to be pretty aligned with that because, you know, I think we have something like really big, like very big to offer in this context.
Okay, our favorite rooftop Korean is back. No, do you have a question?
Hey guys, super exciting as always. This might be a premature question. Feel free to punt if so, and maybe I can just ask it at a theoretical level. You know, as the Keynote infrastructure comes together, takes off, you know, could there theoretically be a point at where it's useful to have a native utility sort of token, and what sort of utility could that facilitate that wouldn't be done just from integrating you know, existing L1s, L2s?
That's a lot of words to say when token.
I'm just asking a theoretical question. Not just when, but what would it actually be doing?
What would it do? Yeah. I mean, actually, Doria, you want to take this? Because like, this is something we have theorized about this question.
Sure.
A lot.
I've thought about it once or twice. On an idle Sunday afternoon. There's a lot of places where you do need some kind of global coordination global coordination tool for a decentralized operating system. You're running a network. There's certain things you want to be globally available. There's certain things that are globally available that need to be ranked or sorted in some way. And so, yeah, you do have a really natural fit for like, some kind of like utility based, economic incentive system. So one place, you know, that the identity thing comes up very quickly. That's sort of like a popular place people look to do stuff like this. There is something there, obviously. These are, you have an identity that's an on-chain primitive, and then you want to assign some value to an identity, reputation-based staking, being able to have a sort of a governance vote in the administration of that public key infrastructure. So for example, right, we have like a top level domain system. You can create different contracts, which administrate different top level domains. We use like .os as sort of like a default catch-all. And then we'll be adding more. So there's then a natural question of like, oh, who gets to administrate it? Well, there could be an auction-based system. There could be a time-based system for that where you can get, you can lease control. And this can all be automated on chain. So yeah, obviously some sort of like governance-based token structure there. Also, yeah, on an individual node level, staking value to emphasize your like humanity, emphasize your, you know, status. But then aside from the identity system, there's a whole bunch of other places where you have this global state. So one of those is in like the networking utility, basically discovering if you're running a node and you don't have a static IP and port and you don't have the sort of physical infrastructure necessary to run web services, you have to then negotiate with other people on the network to act as discovery nodes or routing nodes for you. So if you're familiar with like the WebRTC protocol, there's turn servers, which basically route packets between peer-to-peer users. And there's stun servers, which act as like discovery nodes that help you establish a direct peer-to-peer connection. Both of those utilities like have a very, very important place in like sort of what the Keynode OS is doing. And so there you definitely want to see like some sort of economic incentive or payment system for people running those services. And since they're so tightly integrated in the OS, that would be a place where it'd be like, yeah, that's our responsibility, as opposed to like just some third party that's launching a service. I guess the last example would be like the App Store. That's another piece of like global state that you want coordinated between people. And that's another place where staking and ranking and burning in order to establish status or establish a position within this global state would be valuable. And again, that's a place where like we are going to take responsibility for that, because like literally it's not even a matter of like, oh, we need to find a place to be responsible. It's if we don't, this whole thing falls apart, because we've seen empirically like when that gets sort of like outsourced, it just doesn't work. So yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Let me put that into also like a sort of general framework, which is that there's a lot of things that need to be orchestrated in our system. We don't even know what they all are yet prior to like seeing how people will use this. And so one important use of having a token would be, you know, to have the option of orchestrating those things as they arise. And that's actually pretty normal if you look at how a lot of other tokens are used. Like a lot of the ways they're used now don't necessarily correspond to like, you know, what people imagined and like when they were first launched. But having them gives you the ability to start adding in, you know, useful alignment mechanisms after that. The most well-known example is just everything that ETH's changed over the years, where they've kept the base token having value and growing, but like, you know, what it's done, how it like interacts with the system has definitely, you know, changed somewhat like over time. And it's been, you know, very, very successful.
All right, great. Okay, I guess I'll do sort of a summative recap question. We've covered a lot of this stuff, but my recap question is, can you guys just say, what do you see getting built on Keynode plus crypto that maybe is difficult or impossible elsewhere?
Wait, can you repeat that for me? Sorry.
Yeah, so basically it's a what can you build question. A recap maybe of things we talked about before and anything else that springs to mind that you know you can build with the combination of Keynode and crypto.
Sure. Well, I'll let other people answer, maybe Goldfinger, but I guess my one sentence thing is any peer-to-peer decentralized protocol that wants to not have the transaction as the single sort of base unit of interaction.
Goldfinger, you still there?
Yeah, not much to add.
I mean, yeah, I think anything that's that feels more like an application where you have like a much more detailed kind of thing that you need to then commit to a global state in a very reliable manner, like where you're sure of how the computation happened, I think is what we'll be adding. So that's been starting with like pretty basic things like, okay, let's, you know, much more cheaply update the NFT data for, you know, metadata for NFTs, which is, you know, useful in the game context. So the price point really matters there. We've also, you know, I think we'll also start to see some social stuff for sure, or sort of organization stuff where people micromanage a lot more aspects of like, you know, a DAO or a community or other, like other things like that. And I think just basically you can almost think of it as a lot of these interactions already exist in crypto. But by making them more granular, you make them more real. Like, for example, most stuff in DAOs is that happens at a very, very kind of chunky level, like big based votes, stuff like that. And we can let you, you know, drill down a lot more and you can automate a lot more things, verify a lot more about them, and do that. So just making a lot of these, you know, game application community type things much more verified at all levels, and with a lot, you know, a lot less trust, much more like protocol-ish, at like a much more granular level, because we're opening up a ton of bandwidth.
Yeah. Speaking of bandwidth, you know, application level ideas where users have to share like lots of data with one another is just a very broad class of thing that is interesting. So, you know, real-time streaming of content, anytime you want to like have people run like, you know, oh, maybe they want to like stream themselves playing a game or like share video content with one another. Anytime you have like even just, yeah, large files being moved around, like torrenting stuff, you know, obviously like BitTorrent is a very powerful protocol. It's a very interesting protocol, and has a lot of valid uses, right? And it's just the kind of thing where you want to be able to use that in the way that it's meant to be used. Like you don't want to hamstring that into like a blockchain or anything like that. And the costs would be prohibitive anyway. But then tying that into crypto, so having some sort of payment structure or incentive structure, or even like Oracle-based operations, although that kind of gets into a more research question than just here, go build it.
You know what I was just thinking right now? You were saying the cost would be prohibitive of making like, you know, let's say a protocol on top of BitTorrent. But the other thing that would be prohibitive is the time costs. And it's currently very, very hard to experiment with new sort of small protocols on top of things. And I think that's where, you know, us plus ZK proving of normal languages can really open things up. Because I think right now smart contracts have just this incredibly long life cycle of development and deployment where it's not interesting to test them, or it's just you don't get enough feedback fast enough. And I think we can make that loop much faster. Actually, possibly, you know, at least one, maybe two, maybe three orders of magnitude faster. In that, definitely it's one.
Definitely the case that like that the development life cycle for smart contract based stuff is like massively longer, but it's also like it's massively more complex, because if you look at like new protocols that people are doing on chain, which are very exciting, I mean, the whole game now is how you build around like MEV and how you really have to have like a really deep understanding of like the chain's mechanics in order to build a compelling program. That's another thing, by the way, with layer ones, right? With like non-EVM layer ones, or maybe layer twos as well, but I think in particular layer ones have this issue because they're so wrapped up in like their sort of like sovereign token, is that if you don't understand the mechanics of the chain, it's possible that nobody does. And so your program can just sort of like live out in the wild for a very long time and not be exploited. But like in the long run, it's, unless you have a very, very deep understanding, your program is probably going to be suboptimal in a way that's exploitable, right? Even like, you know, we saw like Paradigm is having like this new leaderless auction primitive, which is a really, it's actually kind of a confusing thing. I thought about it in the context of like, what if somebody came into this and didn't know a lot about like crypto or Ethereum in particular? If they saw this protocol that was being proposed by Paradigm, they would be like, well, like, this is weird. This is like, why are you doing it this way? It's a simple protocol, but it's sort of like, it's confusing why they did it that way. But it makes sense if you look at the problem space that they're really hell-bent on fixing, which is like the, I have a blockchain that is focused on liveness over fairness, right? And we have a proposer system that lets people get last looks on stuff that's about to get executed. And so we have this like very unfair environment, essentially, which is the root of a lot of like MEV stuff on Ethereum in particular. And it's like, if you're building like a random app, like, again, if people don't care, like, it's fine. And there were like a lot of protocols which are from the earlier days of like Ethereum, where people just didn't care, people didn't know, and it just kind of worked fine. But then once there's actual value to be extracted, your design becomes bad, which is unfortunate. Do you know what I mean? Is that like, makes sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense. I think you can like maybe take it back a level, which is just, you know, stripping away some of the complexity and overhead of launching these things. You know, helps a lot on a number of those dimensions. And I think that the very specific nature of, you know, low bandwidth L1s and L2s are creating some, like, you know, some weird mechanics and some like and side effects that I think something like this could, you know, sort of get us out of for some period. Like that stuff is getting maybe sort of over rationalized because there isn't enough room for kind of, you know, blue ocean innovation.
Yeah, no, and I think that's like the consensus opinion now, because again, like looking at the leaderless auction structure, basically what's being proposed is, instead of the former standard, which was that people would submit bids to like an on-chain contract, and then the best bid would be selected, you know, on an intra-block level. You're doing a lot of coordination peer-to-peer off-chain, which kind of assumes away the integration problem that we're so focused on fixing, which is, you know, it's cool to see people who assume that away still. It's good. And then at the very end, once you've come to a sort of internal consensus off-chain, then you post the results on-chain, right, in a permissionless way. And it's like, okay, that's exactly the kind of mechanism which we need to exist in order to build realistically. You know, like, I encourage anybody to like go look at like the leaderless auction protocol that's proposed and think through like, okay, what if I wanted to build this today? Right? How do I do it? It's really not complicated. You need to invent new primitives, essentially. And so that's exactly the kind of stuff we're working on. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I guess so I think like having the new primitives is really cool. And then maybe at the sort of the more grug brain level, I might want to start talking to people about, you know, making smart contracts fun again. I think people don't remember, who weren't around, how fun it was to make smart contracts in 2016, 2017. You could just do stuff. And then after you did it, people would come in and be like, oh, that's not going to be like gas efficient. Obviously that won't scale. You're doing it this way. And I think like, that's fine. It's all true. But then that's like sort of inevitably gone in this more and more rationalized and productionized direction, where it's actually very hard to let people innovate. It's almost, by analogy, it's like if you could only write serious programs in assembly. And there's like, and if you can have stuff that, you know, enables you to do less efficient things, but have them work because they're not targeting a layer that's totally efficiency bound, you can start to do a lot more stuff. So I think that's like where I'd really like, you know, where I'd really like to see things go, would just be to make that stuff fun again. And I think, you know, realistically, if you want to see a good version of, you know, even like ICOs happen, you need to get, well, actually regular people hacking or regular programmers hacking. And actually that isn't an audience that Solana to some degree has captured. I think they'll ultimately be dissatisfied with that, but they have somewhat captured the audience of like, I want to, you know, write programs in Rust and like, you know, do things on the blockchain and write program and do that. And so I think they're kind of hinting at this idea of making smart contracts fun again, but I think, you know, we can sort of actually deliver that by taking out a lot of the ceremony and specific knowledge that you need.
Okay. I'll give everybody just like another couple of seconds if you want to ask permission to
to speak, to ask a question. All right. Otherwise, gentlemen, is there anything else that we want to cover? We feel pretty good about covering all that stuff.
No, feel good. I feel like we generated a lot of, yeah, sort of put together some ideas about what we've been doing. It's a good way to kind of think it out on the fly.
Okay. In that case, thanks everybody for showing up and listening. The next couple of weeks, we have some very interesting guests who will be coming on. So stick around. Keep watching our Twitter. If you look under this, the tweet for this space, you'll see that there's our Discord that you can join, especially for developers. But anybody who wants to join can join our Discord, and our developers are always there. That's where we do sort of our building out in the open. So please feel free to join us on our Discord. And yeah, thanks again for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for showing up. And we'll see you next time.
All right.
Later.